Almost breaking even, and in some we were losing money, but it was an investment because we needed to get it on the heads of all of these women.
You're listening to Side Hustle Pro, the podcast that teaches you to build and grow your side hustle from passion project to profitable business. And I'm your host, Nikayla Matthews Okome. So let's get started. Before I started side hustling, I had no idea how much time pitching, drafting proposals, creating contracts, and managing clients would take. The good news is that HoneyBook can help with all of those tedious admin tasks so you can get back to doing what you love. HoneyBook is an online business management tool that organizes your client communications, your bookings, your contracts, and more all in one place. It's perfect for freelancers, side hustlers, or small business owners that want to consolidate services they already use, like Google Suite, Excel, and MailChimp. With HoneyBook, you can automate all of that. They have easy-to-use templates for emails, proposals, brochures, and invoices. They also have e-signatures and built-in automation to save you time. So simplify your to-do list and stay in control with HoneyBook. And right now, HoneyBook is offering Side Hustle Pro listeners 50% off when you visit tryhoneybook.com/hustlepro. Payment is flexible, and this promotion applies whether you pay monthly or annually. So go to tryhoneybook.com/hustlepro for 50% off your first year. That's tryhoneybook.com/hustlepro. Hey, hey guys, welcome back to the show. Today in the guest chair, we have Tracy Pickett, founder of Hairbrella. Hairbrella is an innovative rain hat combining fashion and function to protect women's hair from the rain. Hairbrella was launched on Kickstarter and was successfully funded in December 2016. Since then, this passionate entrepreneur, attorney, inventor, and speaker has invested her money, time, blood, sweat, and tears into bringing Hairbrella from an idea and prototype to fully developed product on the market. In today's episode, you will hear how Tracy began her legal career at a Fortune 5 technology company working in the areas of corporate and intellectual property law. And you'll also hear that she was an attorney by day and spent nights and weekends developing her passion for entrepreneurship. In 2014, she launched her first entrepreneurial venture, Eboticon, a media design company with a mission to create dynamic and culturally relevant emojis for niche social groups. Then in November 2016, Tracy left her job to lead Eboticon full-time and to launch her second entrepreneurial venture, which was Hairbrella. In today's episode, Tracy breaks down the financial investments she made to patent and prototype Hairbrella, how she used early user feedback to continue to develop and improve her product, and how she pushed past the earliest challenges in her business to make a product that is stylish and also works. Let's get right into it. All right. So welcome to the guest chair, Tracy.
Thank you so much. Glad to be here.
Appreciate you being here. So first things first, give us a peek into your background, the life of Tracy. Who are you and what was your first experience with side hustling?
Yeah, so I'm a native of Atlanta with Spelman and UGA for law school. I was a lawyer by trade, but always had a passion for entrepreneurship and decided to get, law school out of the way, got a job, and then the entrepreneurial bug started, kind of tapping on my shoulder. And I decided to band together with some colleagues, three other co-founders, to basically what was really intended to be a test, to test one of my ideas that I had formulated, a couple years prior, called Eboticon. And that was going to be an emoji app that represented our culture, which at the time we didn't even have like skin tones for emojis. So I was like, this is one of the ideas I have. Let's test it out. Let's put it out there. And we did that on nights and weekends after I left my job. So I would, drive to Alpharetta. On the way back, we would stop at one of my co-founders' apartments in Buckhead, and we developed this app and all put $2,000 in to see if it would fly. And so that was the beginning of this journey.
Wow. I love that you said you, you know, decided to get law school out the way as if it wasn't, you know, a 3-year program. Right. But what made you pursue law?
Yeah. So I, as a kid, my dad is a pastor, and it's funny, like we went to a church one time and I was sitting in the pew with him, and this lady walked in who was one of the public defenders in Fulton County. And he tapped me and was like, "She's a lawyer." And I was like, "Oh, like that's a big deal." And I remember thinking like, okay, I want to be a lawyer because I want to be important. I want to be somebody that my dad would like point out. I didn't want to be a pastor, but that sounded like it had some of the same weight. So, and then my godmother was also an attorney. And I heard they made a lot of money. And you know, people used to tell me too, like, "Hey, you would make a great lawyer," because I would, always require that things are fair amongst my, you know, my sister and my friends. So anyway, it was kind of one of those things that was kind of imposed, and I thought, hey, not a bad idea. So that's why I went down that road initially. And also I'm a musician, so I've been playing drums since I was 12 years old. And a lot of my musician friends ended up, you know, going on to play for pretty much every artist you can think of. And I'm like, I'll just be the friend that became the lawyer and can help them. So wanted to go into entertainment law, you know, help creative people, and still feel like, you know, in a way I still enjoy doing that, but that's how I initially got into law.
So interesting. I love hearing all the multi-passions that everyone has. Now, so you start Ebotacon with some friends, you're doing this, you know, after work each day. What was that initial $2,000 investment from each of you guys for?
Yeah, so that was for actually coding the app, and then getting our initial library of emoji, and they were gifts. So we got an animator to create them for us and do all the artwork. And then, of course, you know, all the back end platform stuff that we needed to get it up. We actually started with just 12 emojis.
So let's talk about the pivot from law, the pivot from Ebotacon. What inspired you to do that? Some, you know, 2 years after going in on that venture, what inspired you to start Hairbrella and pivot from law and Ebotacon?
Yeah, so I actually wrote a letter to myself the summer before I went to law school. I still have, well, it was an email form. And I said, "Hey, Tracy, you have all of these great ideas that you want to pursue, but you're about to go to law school and need to stay focused. So promise me that you will not spend more than 5 years in full-time legal career without pursuing these." And at the time, I didn't have the idea for Hairbrella, but I had something similar to the idea for Ebotacon. And I literally just kept myself to that promise. So in pursuing Ebotacon, that was one idea that I felt like I could develop while I was still working. Mm-hmm. And one that I had co-founders to help me with. It wasn't long after that that I got the idea for Hairbrella, and I started working on the patent for that almost immediately. And so in the background of doing Ebotacon, I was also very slowly iterating on Hairbrella. And then I ended up leaving my job on my 5th anniversary, like literally the day.
Wow.
And I worked all the way up until that point to kind of get ready for, you know, what I knew was coming, my deadline. And I also paced myself to complete kind of, you know, the first version that I could go out and test of Hairbrella, and then launched a Kickstarter campaign right after leaving my job, you know, with Hairbrella's, you know, prototype in hand, ready to launch. Ebotacon was doing pretty well. We were getting some bigger contracts, so I felt confident about at least supporting the team through Ebotacon. And then I saved a year's worth of income so that I can give myself a little runway to you know, be able to push both of those having left my job.
All right. Now,
yeah.
I love that you mentioned patent and you mentioned prototype. Let's talk a little bit more about those things. So
sure.
When you had the idea for Hairbrella, did you initially start developing a patent? And what is required for you to even file for a patent?
I wanted to make sure I could protect the idea
right
before I would pour a lot of money into the development. And in terms of what you need initially, it really is just about searching to see what's out there already. A lot of that you can do on your own. And then I went to a firm that could help me to do the provisional patent application. And that required for me to get someone to do some technical drawings. Mm-hmm. I actually kind of put together a makeshift version of it with beanies and shower caps and had to try to describe to them what I thought it should look like.
Right.
And then I went back and forth with a contractor who I just found online, mm-hmm. Who helped me to create the initial drawings and then sent that over to the firm. And, you know, they made some updates to that just to make sure I provide enough detail. And then you have a year after that, you know, to file the full patent application. Is really interesting story about that, because, you know, the provisional only costs, you know, about $100. And of course, whatever you spend with the contractors. But then when you do the full application, that can be $1,800, $2,400. It costs a whole lot more. And being, you know, still in school, I said, hey, there's no way that I'm going to be able to just throw money at this for no reason. Like, let me, God, give me a sign if I'm supposed to use all my little savings on this patent application. And the night before I had the deadline to end for my provisional, I went to a restaurant in Atlanta called Nakato, and Sarah Blakely was escorted to our hibachi table at Nakato and sat next to me.
Sarah Blakely being the founder of Spanx.
Exactly. Okay. And she was one of my, of course, I mean, she was the biggest inspiration, you know, aside from Oprah.
Yeah.
I was like, okay, I know her whole story. I know she spent $5,000, mm-hmm. you know, of her savings to start Spanx. And that was my sign. I said, I'm not looking back. Like, what are the chances?
Wait, so you mentioned you were in school. So had you started the process while you were in law school?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Of filing the patent. Had the idea.
Yes, exactly. Wow. I had the idea. Yeah. I hadn't started developing it yet, mm-hmm. Because I wanted to make sure there was a good chance that I would actually get the patent,
right,
before I started, you know, putting money towards development.
Got it. Because I know, yep. You know, let's be honest, Black women, all of us have at some point in time thought, I need, like, is there a waterproof cap? Like, this is an idea that multiple people have had, but you took it a step further and said, you know what, I want to make sure that I can patent what I am going to create. And before I invest any more resources and what have you into this process. So now,
absolutely.
Fast forward, you're out of law school. What were the first steps you took to get started? And what did it require financially?
Wow. So the first step was to find somebody who could sew, because it was not me. I could not sew. I didn't have any of the skills necessary to put it together. And so I needed to find contractors. I didn't even know what to call people that make hats. So doing a lot of research online was kind of the beginning process. I had read in certain like business books, you know, go into, look and see what's on the market. So I started reading reviews from rain hats that existed. And then I started, you know, pulling family and friends and even people after church into a room and asking them, like, you know, well, if there were a hat that could protect your hair from the rain, like, what would you care about? And so that was the beginning process. And I probably went through three different kind of like consulting companies to help me make it, because it's not a hat in the traditional sense of hat makers. We're like, we wouldn't make this. And so had to even figure out, you know, who to use. And so that process was, you know, a couple years of having to start the process and then let those people go because they weren't necessarily able to help me with my vision the way that I really wanted it to be. So yeah, that was the beginning process.
And it's so interesting that you mentioned that, because you're right, not everyone can help you realize the vision, especially when you're doing something outside of the normal creation that they make. And when you created your prototype, the idea that the version that it is today with kind of more room for our hair, right? So you can have, mm-hmm. you know, a little bit of hair, you can have a whole braided hairstyle, what have you, and still fit into it. Did that evolve over time?
Oh, absolutely. The size of it has been a big ordeal because you have to factor in the size of someone's head and then the length and volume of their hair. And really, you know, I was like, well, the average shower cap, we don't look for sizes in shower caps. Why are we looking for sizes here? But the premise for Hairbrella is that your hair, however it is styled, won't be disrupted. So we needed to provide for more space. And, you know, we initially started with one size, which is more of like what the XL is now. And we found that some women, even though it had plenty of room, if they wore their hair short, they wanted the Hairbrella to reflect that. So like the fact that it looked like it was hanging, like hair was hanging down when they put it on, they're like, I don't want to wear this. I want it to look like my hair. And I'm like, okay. Like I didn't realize people would care about that. So yeah, we've had to, I mean, it's been over 60 prototypes over the years. And
wow. Over 60
prototypes. And some of them are iterations on things that on versions that look similar. So if you think about like version 4.7, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. But overall there's 60 different versions of it. And, the one that we have today really does take into account the feedback that we got from Kickstarter, which was really the purpose of that campaign.
Right.
I had 250 to sell and I wanted to get all the feedback that I could. And then I went into another 6 months of development. So that was really important. You know, the prototype was okay. But then when we went through, you know, listening to all those women, we really got a product that I felt like resonated with women because we took into consideration everything they wanted.
Right. And let's backtrack a little bit, because I think it's really important for people to understand the financial aspects of this, just so you can know what you need to save up. Right. So
you created
that Kickstarter. How much did you raise? Right. And is that what you used to invest in the early like development with different consulting groups and all of that? Talk us about that financial process.
Yes, I apologize. I forgot that you asked about the actual money. So the money, initially I was just putting in whatever I had that was extra. And I would say in the year leading up to, well, 2 years leading up to my job, I probably invested about $60,000 in product development. And that was a combination of the three contractors that I went through, contracting companies, probably spent, you know, $5,000 to $10,000 in, developing and doing different iterations, buying materials, that sort of thing. And then when I finally found the one that was perfect for me and really got my vision, you know, spent another $30,000, which also included, you know, small runs. So you want to get, you know, 10 of them made. I'll tell you that initially, each one costs like $52 to make.
Whoa.
Because I was paying the person's hourly rate.
Whoa.
So yeah. And then got it down to $36, between $32 and $36 by Kickstarter. And you know, you are able to improve from there. But and I didn't have all that raised at one time. This is all my personal money. And in fact, there was a class action lawsuit that I was paid out on kind of midway through, right after I finished like the very first, very ugly prototype. And I just felt like God was giving me more money after I ran out. You know, I spent all that I could, and then, you know, it would be an opportunity for me to make more money or get more money to keep putting into it. So in total, it was about $60,000, but, you know, that was spread out over 2 years of just kind of using all my bonuses, keeping my expenses low, you know,
got
my tax returns.
Yeah, that is very, very helpful to know. So then you do the Kickstarter. Why did you do the Kickstarter?
I did it only for testing. Like I said, I had 250 units. We raised about $16,000. The goal was $15,000. My boss from my job actually bought like the first, I think it was 100 units. I gave them out to the whole law department. So I was like, oh, great.
What a great job. Boss. What?
Yes,
that's awesome.
Right. So yeah, and we only had 250. I didn't even have the money to invest in getting more than that. And we were not making any money off of them from the pledges. We actually were almost breaking even, and then some we were losing money, but it was an investment because we needed to get it on the heads of all of these women so that they could give us their feedback. So after we sold through the 250, you know, we couldn't sell anymore. And then we went into, you know, testing and surveying everybody and getting all their feedback, and then back into product development to make it better.
So what kind of feedback did they give you that you use to inform the next generation of the hats?
Yeah. So, one big revelation was that, rain has velocity. So we had a material that like had water, you could sit water on it all day and it would never seep through. But when rain was falling and it was hard, you know, coming down really hard, then it would seep through. And so we learned, you know, under what conditions our material did not work under. I hadn't worn it in every climate, so I didn't know that. We didn't realize that how snow affected it. People told us, you know, this material feels kind of hot. People said, oh, when I tried to wash it, you know, the visor bent up and I couldn't get it to recover. There were all kinds of types of feedback that we got, all the way down to the size of it. So they really address every aspect of the hat. And I would say, you know, 100 of them were really, really, you know, gave us some great feedback. Not everybody, was able to give us that feedback, but, we took into account everything that they said and just made iterations on the hat itself and made it something that now, you know, has extremely, you know, really, really good reviews now, less than 1% return rate. And that is a direct reflection of all the feedback that we got from those women.
That is a really good return rate. And you know what's funny? When you were talking about some of the feedback and someone saying the visor got bent up, I imagine them like throwing it in their washing machine like, no.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Was that you,
yeah.
Or was that me?
Right. Yes, absolutely. Yes. Yeah.
So that's great that you got that feedback. Now, what would you say was the biggest challenge once you've received all that feedback? Like, how it sounds to me like almost impossible to make a product that can satisfy all of those different needs.
Yeah. I definitely had to make some, I guess, you know, qualitative assessments of what really mattered and didn't. The things that I heard more than once or twice, I really took into account. Some things were people being nitpicky and just wanting to design their own hat.
Right. a magic hat.
Exactly. And some of the things that people were asking for, I'm like, so yeah, like for instance, can you make one that protects my hair from being, you know, sweated out in the gym? I'm like, oh, I can.
That's a different
stop.
Product, ma'am. Okay.
Right? Coming out of your scalp, we don't really have anything for that.
Yes.
But yeah, so they were very helpful, and we just had to kind of figure out which ones we thought were going to really kind of impact the user experience to the extent that I would rather go without having a solution than to have this problem with this hat. You know what I mean? Some things are more cosmetic, some things don't really matter, but other things I felt like were really going to affect whether or not someone would use it and want to tell other people about it. And those were the things we prioritized.
And how long did it take you to go from that Kickstarter testing phase to do a full launch and, you know, launch the website and officially put them up for sale?
Oh my gosh. So we ended the campaign January of 2017. We put up a e-commerce site like middle of the year around July, I think it was. And you know, sales were trickling in here and there, but one of the biggest issues that came up soon after that was that the material that we use, I sourced out of Atlanta. We bought all of it, and the supplier didn't know what it was made of, where he could get more of it from. He was a jobber, so that means that he just gets excess fabric. And I'm thinking, oh, it's going to be an unlimited supply. You're always going to get this. He's like, no, that was our last roll. And so I went around the country, and so did my product development person, looking for the material. Couldn't find it. We ended up having to reverse engineer it in China. That process took over a year. And then after that, we needed to get our first full run. So finding a manufacturer who could make it for way less than $32.
Yes, that was my next question.
That took another several months because, you know, when you make something that hasn't been made before, you have to now create a new manufacturing process that is scalable. And that was more than a notion. I didn't realize how much would have to go into that, not only just training people, having them understand how the hat should work, but the machinery that they would need and the components that we would need to source and how those components can be sourced in a way that doesn't drive up our price or it's affect the weight of shipping. I mean, it was really incredible going through that process. So it wasn't until, honestly, March of 2019 that we had all of the pieces together, meaning we had a manufacturer, we had the ability to produce it and source the materials and make the right kind of fabric. And then I raised a little money to do a rebrand of the site so that we could, you know, look like a legitimate company. And then we launched our first marketing campaign. And that was, you know, another thing we had to figure out, how to market rain hats. Right. You don't see rain hat commercials. You don't know how they market it. So we had to figure that out too. And so that process, I mean, that's been since 2017 all the way to 2019. That we were, yeah, we were selling, but not really operating like a fully, you know, equipped company, because there were these pieces that would not allow us to really grow. We were running out of inventory every month. We couldn't keep paying the price we were paying for the production. So we had to go through that process.
And it's interesting that you say that. So what is working now for you as far as marketing?
Marketing, we were doing Facebook ads. I had no clue how to do marketing. And thankfully, I was able to have an angel investor who had a hair growth company, hair growth product company. He was making over $100,000 a month in sales through his e-commerce channel. And I was like, okay, yes, please be an investor and please teach me how to do this. And so we've been focusing on Facebook ads. I locked myself in a room with him for 8 hours every couple of months and started iterating. And once we kind of found the right copy, the right visuals, which was, you know, pouring water on a model's head, which seemed to be the one that performed the best. At that point, we really had a marketing campaign that had, you know, very high conversion rate. We were able to really resonate with the audience that we knew was interested in the product. And we've been growing, you know, over, it was like 100% month over month, the second part of last year. And, you know, now we're trying to really capitalize on that, ramp up on production. It's kind of been like, this is what you dream of when you first start a product or start a company. But, you know, the road getting here kind of just felt like, wow, like, is it ever going to happen? And it's absolutely happening now, but it definitely took a lot to get to this point.
Hey guys, it's Nikayla here with a quick word from our sponsors. If you listen to my episode on How to Make Money Podcasting, then you know that I pitched my very first sponsor 6 months after launching this show. And you know what else I did once I landed the contract? I invoiced them using FreshBooks. FreshBooks made it so simple. That's because FreshBooks invoicing and accounting software is designed specifically for small business owners. It's simple, it's intuitive, and it keeps you organized. FreshBooks lets you create and send professional-looking invoices in 30 seconds and then get them paid 2 times faster with automated online payments. Plus, you can file expenses even quicker and keep them perfectly organized for tax time. And the best part? FreshBooks grows alongside your business, so you'll always have the tools you need when you need them without ever having to learn how to do accounting. Try it free for 30 days, no catch and no credit card required. Go to freshbooks.com/sidehustlepro and enter Side Hustle Pro in the How Did You Hear About Us section to get started. Again, that's freshbooks.com/sidehustlepro and tell them Side Hustle Pro sent you. This episode is sponsored by Skillshare. The online learning community is offering Side Hustle Pro listeners 2 months of free premium membership. Explore new skills, deepen existing passions, and get lost in creativity with classes from Skillshare. My number one side hustle advice is to always be a lifelong learner. That means continue learning new ways to grow your business each and every week. For me, that comes through Skillshare. There's so many awesome classes on Skillshare on topics like email marketing, Instagram hacks, setting up your own website, copywriting, and much more. What I like to focus on are classes to fine-tune my skills. Most of the classes are under 60 minutes with short lessons to fit any schedule. And I tend to listen to classes on 2x speed because I want to get as many in as possible. I recently took a Skillshare class called Copywriting Tips from Beginner to Advanced and found it so valuable because I'm in a zone right now where I'm laser focused on the copywriting in my Facebook ads, which I know some of you guys are seeing, and Skillshare has been very helpful with that. Whatever your business needs, though, you can find a class for it on Skillshare. Explore your creativity at skillshare.com/sidehustlepro, where you'll get 2 free months of premium membership. That's 2 free months of premium membership at skillshare.com/sidehustlepro. I would love to see the, you know, kind of evolution of the prototypes as like one of those hyperlapse, is that what they call it? Fast beat, because it's cute now.
Yes. No, that's a great idea. Cute. I'm going to do that. Right. I have to do that. I'm
like,
I will
this
do
is
that.
Like a fashion piece now, and it is also useful. So kudos to you for, you know, evolving and all of that. And you mentioned angel investors. So let's talk a little bit about that as well, because as you're talking about this process, all I can think about is the amount you have invested, the years that have passed, and that it's still such a work in progress. So my question is, how are you funding this? How are you paying yourself, if at all?
Yes, good question. So I ended up getting angel investors after I discovered that we had this issue with the fabric.
Okay.
And so I needed to have them help me invest in reverse engineering this fabric and getting our initial production run. And so Nathaniel Bronner was my first investor of the Bronner brothers. And then shortly after that, you know, I met Ron Love and Tyron Spear, who I just spoke about at the Gathering Spot here in Atlanta. So the Gathering Spot is, you know, where all the entrepreneurs are hanging out, and end up meeting them. And then also Jewel Burks at the same time, who sold her company PartPick to Amazon a couple years ago. And so they were kind of my initial investors, and they, while we weren't making the kind of sales that would demonstrate to them that they were going to make their investment back, they did take a chance on helping me get to the point where we could fully market and see the potential of Hairbrella go forward. And so, you know, the investment amounts were between, you know, 10,000 and 40,000. And then there was a mix of, you know, some equity financing and some were loans. All in all, I've raised about 170,000, again, with that mix. So none of them, you know, were mortgaging their house to invest. But it was definitely, you know, enough for us to keep going and stay afloat. And then personally, so I was, none of that was paying for my expenses. I was doing consulting and still doing legal work, primarily IP, trademark applications. And my former boss, who is amazing, clearly, gave me the opportunity to just basically help. They needed help with a project that I was working on when I was at my job. And they were like, hey, just work from home. If you could just help us through, you know, bill us your hourly rate, whatever that is. And so I was able to, you know, take a few hours every day and work for my old job, and then continue working on Hairbrella as well. And so I would say maybe 4 or 5 months out of the year, in 2 of those years, I was still doing some consulting and legal work. And then, you know, the rest of the time I was just building Hairbrella and doing consulting on the side as I could.
That is so good to know. I love the fact that, you know, Jewel, who has been in the Side Hustle Pro guest chair, is now paying it forward in terms of supporting, helping, educating new entrepreneurs. And I've heard lots of great things about the Gathering Spot, that co-working community in Atlanta. And, you know, it's good to know. Sometimes when we hear about raising and all this other stuff, we think it has to be, I shouldn't say we think it has to be, because I don't know what everyone thinks, but people tend to publicize millions of fundraising, like, oh, they raised a million, but what you really need to get your business by is often way less than that. And you're doing it. And you're now starting to see those results because of the investment in studying the Facebook advertising and sitting down and doing that. So when do you think the business will really start to sustain itself and be profitable?
We are at the point now where our cost of acquisition, so marketing costs and the cost of the product, is now less than what we charge for it. So we see the way to profitability. What we're focusing on now is scaling up production. So I went to China a couple months ago to kind of figure out what our production capacity was. We're still running out of inventory. I mean, we sold over $100,000 both in November and December, and ran out of inventory on the 22nd.
Oh no.
Yeah. So we're trying to get production going, you know, at scale. We feel confident that we have the marketing piece figured out so we can get that at scale. And so, we're raising so that we can, fully max out the potential. We have some exciting opportunities with Good Morning America coming up. and also Essence Women in Hollywood. And so there's a lot of growth that is happening now. And we have to have the money to run that, because you have to have all the inventory ahead of time. And you've also got to be able to spend those marketing dollars to pull those customers in. So in terms of it being profitable, it will be this year, based on what we're projecting. We're just trying to make sure that we've got the runway in terms of cash to truly get there. But I won't say the hardest part is over, but we definitely have something that we can grow tremendously at this point, you know, kind of having all those pieces in place.
You know, I just love hearing your story, Tracy, and I'm really, really rooting for you. Investors would be silly jump on this bandwagon, but on this boat before it pops, because it is just such a good idea and so useful. But then you bring up such important considerations that product-based business have to think about. I would never think that you would run out of inventory in terms of fabric. Like, you really start reverse engineering the process and realizing it's great that we have demand, but now we have to make sure our factory has enough fabric. Where do they get fabric from? Who sews it? Like, how does it end up in the factory, and at what pace does it do that? So is it a matter of where, if you produce at scale, you have to move to a larger fabric? Do you have to trademark the fabric? Like, how does that whole thing work?
Yeah. So when I went to China, I went to every factory, from the raw materials to the dyeing factory to the actual place where they apply the waterproof laminate on the fabric. And why it's so important and why this was so particular is because I needed it to be waterproof and not feel like a shower cap. Mm. I needed to drape like a beanie. It needed to feel like a hat that you would want to wear, not like a shower cap. So, In figuring out that process, we needed to do it where it could be at any scale. And that's where we have it now. So we can produce as much as we want at this point. But that took us finding this is the same factory that makes the bedding for like some of the biggest bedding companies and upholstery companies in the world. So capacity on the fabric isn't a problem, but we have to also kind of be at a level that would warrant, you know, basically their MOQ, their minimum order quantity. So we have to be selling really well to keep them on as a vendor. Mm-hmm. So that's what we've had to kind of get to a point of. And then in terms of the cut and sew factory, same thing. You know, we want to be able to produce as much as we can, but you know, they're gonna do it for the company that pays them,
right.
And who needs the capacity, you know, needs all of the capacity that they offer. And so we kind of had to grow up and kind of get to a point of sales that we could warrant saying, hey, you know, we're going to need X amount of units for this year. Can you guys give us a great price and basically make us the one company that you're working for? And so, that's what we're doing now. And feel confident, you know, we kind of know what we can get to in sales this year based on that capacity.
This is so exciting. And what does the patent cover as far as, can you prevent this factory? I know this is something that a lot of people get concerned about too. Like, can you prevent this factory from making similar hats for someone else?
Yeah. So everybody knows, you know, there's a huge issue with that in China. It's kind of like people take the risk, honestly, to do that. Gratefully, I have a company that is kind of my quality assurance and eyes and ears on the ground out there that manage the factory. And so, it's one of those things where the factory is incentivized. They're the only ones that create it. It's a brand new product. You don't see it anywhere else. They are incentivized to protect the hat, because if they don't, I know who produced it.
Right.
And then all of that money that is paying for all of the things that, I mean, I really enjoyed meeting the factory owner and all of the managers and all that. And we had lunch and did all that stuff. And I was like, wow. And I even looked around like, what else are you guys producing? They weren't producing for anybody else. It's just us. So they would be risking that and all of the money they make month over month by doing that. So we're building that relationship. Like I said, the company or my product quality manager has a very strong relationship with them. And we are building that relationship such that it is mutually beneficial for everybody to protect everybody. but if it were that, you know, someone like, for instance, we did see a website go up for an address in China. They said they were selling the hairbrella. I actually don't think they were ever going to send it because we did try and order one, never came. But my product development guy drove to that address and like shut them down.
Yes. You need that body. You need muscle on the ground, y'all.
Yes, we have police on the ground. They don't even know it over there. So that's, you know, but it's still a vulnerability that I think about. And, you know, it's one of those things I'm trusting and doing all that I can do, you know, as a lawyer, mm-hmm. and also just, you know, protecting something I've invested so much time and energy in. But one other cool thing about it that, you know, if an entrepreneur can come up with a product idea that is hard to make. Mm-hmm. I mean, hairbrella is a really hard product to make.
Yes, you can hear it in how many years you've invested in this. How many prototypes, guys? Yeah, this is not easy.
Right, yeah. Right. And so finding all of the components that I had to find to get it to where it is now, like, you know, it would have to be that factory that would do it. But other than that, I think it would be best for someone to spend their time doing something else and trying to copy.
Yes, yes.
Trying to copy hairbrella. Right. So we'll protect it and grow it and, you know, really want to focus on the brand too, so that people always know that this is the hairbrella in case anybody tries it. But, you know, I'm not going to focus on that too much. I know it's a vulnerability. I just want to focus on making hairbrella as successful as it can be. And I'm going to have to trust God with the rest.
Indeed. And, you know, I saw a quote the other day, in terms of that, you know, having peace of mind during times like this where you make something so great that people want to copy, right? Copying is allegedly the best form of flattery. I don't know about that, but you know.
Right. I can accept other forms.
However, I saw this quote and it says, it's from Stephanie Fleming of The Happy Planner. It's, she said this on the Being Boss podcast, that if someone is copying you or following you too closely, the closest they're ever going to be is one step behind. And that's, true. You know, that's comforting for me because they literally have to wait on your next move. Then they got to spend time reverse engineering that move. And by the time, by the time they do that, you're like another step ahead. So I'm rooting for you. So now tell us what's next for Hairbrella. You mentioned some exciting things like Good Morning America might be coming on. What else?
Yes. Yeah. So we're scheduled to do Good Morning America in March for their women's history kind of special deals and steals segment. So that's going to be incredible. We're going to be included in the Essence Women in Hollywood gift bag, which is in February. And we are in talks with one of the country's biggest airlines to incorporate the hairbrella into their uniformed employees' uniforms, essentially, for their above and below the wing employees. So those that are out on the runway and those that are, flight attendants, et cetera, which would be a huge contract. So we are really excited about the opportunity to do that. And there's a lot of growth, possible with, you know, wholesale accounts for salons, blow dry bar. And we, also group sales like, cheerleading and drill team. And so we're now trying to build out our wholesale kind of B2B part of the business, taking advantage of the television. We haven't done any press, anything. So this will be the first year that we get into that. And then growing our online sales. Another big thing that we're trying to do too is we have customers in different countries that are paying $20, $30 for shipping. So we're setting up distribution in those countries, starting out with the UK, Australia, in India, which has a huge monsoon season during our summer. Yeah. So, those markets are ones that we will be, kind of standing up over the next 12 months. Lots of work.
That raises a question for me. You know, I always assume that everything is for me, but this hat is actually not limited to Black women. Like anybody with hair can use it. So how do you manage, how do you go about targeting when you think of who you're trying to target, who you're trying to get in front of?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I've gone back and forth with that. So our website, the majority of those customers, you know, look like you and me. But when I start selling on Amazon and started, I kind of like go and stalk those customers, try to find them online and see who they were. And I found out that about 60% of those women were not Black. And even down to one of my customers, she actually bought on the website and wanted to invest, and she's Asian. Like, I was talking to her and I was trying to figure out, how am I going to ask her if she is white or Black or what? It was so awkward, but I finally kind of, I found a way to ask her, and she was like, oh no, I'm Asian. And I mean, if you think about it, you know, when you see rain hats, you know, the models on Amazon or anywhere, or you just think about the rainwear industry,
right?
All is made in China and all the models are Asian. It's like, no, she was like, rain hats, ponchos, et cetera, are bigger in China, in Asia in general, than anywhere else.
Wow.
So she's like, this market is going to be huge for you whenever you're ready. So right now, what I'm trying to make sure I do is, you know, stay focused on the market that we know we're serving and who really, you know, is responding to it. And of course, Black women have never had a solution. So I want to make sure that we are really reaching that audience. But there's so many other verticals and so many other women, even the blow dry market, you know, the women that go get their hair at the dry bar or whatever. Right. Those are women that have been looking for a solution as well. So, you know, rain impacts our hair differently. But one thing is true, it never helps our hair. It never helps our hair to stay the way that we wanted it to be. If you've taken any time to style it, water is what will ruin it. And so we want to make sure that we're serving, you know, women everywhere who have different needs for their hair, but are trying to protect it from the rain.
Got it. So now we are going to transition into the lightning round. You just answer the first thing that comes to mind. Are you ready?
I am ready.
All right. Number one, what is a resource that has helped you in your business that you can share with the Side Hustle Pro audience?
That would be podcasts. Ooh. Especially this one. But in leading up to leaving my job, I listened to a podcast about a founder every single day. And that really helped me to build my confidence and also kind of made me feel like I understood what it took to be successful. And that was really, really important for me leading up to leaving my job.
Oh, good to know. Number two, what's been the best business book that has directly helped you with your business?
The 10X Rule by Grant Cardone. And that book really kind of kicked things into gear for me in terms of the work ethic and the amount of action I would need to take to be successful. So I would highly recommend the 10X Rule.
All righty. Number three, what is a non-negotiable part of your daily routine?
Meditation in the morning. I literally feel like I haven't brushed my teeth if I haven't had my time for meditation. So that's every single day.
Okay. And then number four, what is a personal habit that has helped you significantly in your business?
Reading. Reading every day. I have a whole slew of business books and listening to Audible. But reading and being able to revisit those notes and kind of implementing what I've learned has been huge.
Okay. And then finally, what is your parting advice for fellow women entrepreneurs who want to be their own boss but are worried about losing a steady paycheck?
I would say, you know, it is absolutely possible. I think we struggle between what is kind of a leap of faith and what is being silly. And I think that if you can really put down a plan, I call it a vision map. And if you've read Mentor by a Millionaire, or there are several books that talk about goal setting, but if you really kind of back out of the result that you want and mark it down, you know, what are my goals? What are the tasks that are going to get there? What are the things that I know how to do? And what are the things I'm going to have someone else do for me? You will feel more confident and you will actually get to that result. I found that after I had written down the plan, the things that I didn't know how to solve for started showing up. So I think it's really important to get started, to do all that you can until you can't anymore. And then I believe that the resources show up. And also when you are planning, just know that you won't see the way all the way to the end. You just need to see up into that first step. So, you know, leaving my job, I gave myself a deadline, but I think that while going through that planning process and seeing things show up, I was able to build the confidence to keep going and finally get to a point where I have left my job. I'm not doing any more consulting. I'm fully reliant on Hairbrella as my full-time income. And that journey has just been, you know, one foot in front of the next.
I love that. That is such
impactful advice to end this episode with. And before we go, just let everyone know how they can connect with you and get their hands on Hairbrella.
Yes. So you can find me on Instagram at Tracy Pickett Esquire, TRACEYPICKETTESQ. And then at Hairbrella on Facebook, Instagram, all the platforms, Twitter. And you can purchase Hairbrella on hairbrella.com or on Amazon. And if you use Side Hustle Pro 20, ooh, you can get a discount for 20% off your order.
Yay. Yep. So that was Side Hustle Pro, you guys, at hairbrella.com for 20% off your order. That was a surprise to me. That is so kind of you, Tracy. Thank you.
Awesome. Thank you. I appreciate it. I appreciate what you're doing here. Like this, a podcast like this is literally a dream for someone like me. I'm trying to, you know, transition. I'm sure it's going to be great for all the women that are listening to it.
Yes. So there you have it, you guys. Hey guys, thanks for listening to Side Hustle Pro. If you like the show, be sure to subscribe, rate, and review on Apple Podcasts. It helps other side hustlers just like you to find the show. And if you want to hear more from me, you can follow me on Instagram at Side Hustle Pro. Plus, sign up for my 6-bullet Saturday newsletter at sidehustlepro.co/newsletter. When you sign up, you'll receive weekly nuggets from me, including what I'm up to, personal lessons, and my business tip of the week. Again, that's sidehustlepro.co/newsletter to sign up. Talk to you soon.